Let's just get into the middle of this. This is Baptist Beginnings in America. We've covered this whole first section before several weeks ago when we talked about what was going on in the colonies. And you've got early leaders. Roger Williams was considered to be the first Baptist in America. He wrote, and I'm going to give you a couple of these fun titles tonight because I get to talk about fun titles. I love these titles from the 1600s and the 1700s of books and pamphlets and so forth. He wrote, his most famous work was The Bloody Tenet of Persecution, written in 1644. He wrote about Roman Catholic persecution and Church of England persecution and Anglican persecution of Baptists. He started the First Baptist Church in Providence, Rhode Island, stayed there for approximately 4 months before converting to Seekerism, and he went to become a missionary to the Indian, the Native American people in upstate New York. But he is considered, just like John Smythe is considered to be the first Baptist ever, Roger Williams is the first Baptist in America. Dr. John Clark contends against that, and he would say that his congregation in Aquinnah, Rhode Island, the Newport Church there, was the first Baptist congregation because he lasted longer, and he was an actual Baptist who died a Baptist. Then also we've got a couple guys, John Miles, who moved from Swansea, Wales, to Swansea, Massachusetts, to escape the Act of Uniformity. He was in there. William Screven was at Kittery in Maine. He would actually become the pastor that started the First Baptist of Charleston, South Carolina. Now, one of the reasons he did that is because William Screven was a well-to-do merchant who had a lot of trade influence in the trade, early trade routes. And from Kittery, Maine, which is on the coast of Maine, you can take a boat and go right down into the harbor of Charleston, South Carolina, because at the time, Charleston, South Carolina was a major harbor for a lot of the the plantations and so forth in the southern United States. And he had a lot of business down there. So he started two churches that were very significant, and particularly the Charleston church is probably his greatest legacy. Screven was licensed by a Baptist church in Boston because at this time, this is interesting, we think about America, we think about everything's been the same ever since we got started. Well, that wasn't the case. In the colonies, if you were a preacher, you had to be licensed by the local municipality to be legally allowed to preach. And you had to have your ordination through an authorized church. And if you didn't, they'd arrest you. And William Screven was arrested for preaching in an unlicensed, unauthorized Baptist separatist church. And they brought him before the magistrate, and they fined him 40 pounds, which was pretty significant at the time. And he ended up getting it reduced to 10, and then he escaped and he ran down to Charleston, South Carolina. But he was able to go between the two. And then also Pennepec, Pennsylvania, Elias Keach. This would become another significant church in the colonial period. Pennepec would begin the process, and we'll talk about this in a few minutes, of developing the Baptist notion of the association. Because Baptist churches are independent, or the better word that we prefer is autonomous from each other, that means we have no external influence over how each individual Baptist church is run. This is one of the primary Baptist distinctives. If you're in a Presbyterian church, your local synod has authorization over who you hire, your finances, and how your church is run. If you're a Roman Catholic parish, Rome, well, actually, technically, your bishop, which would be, for the Texas region, where is the bishop located? In Galveston, because Galveston used to be the most significant port. And you can still go down to the bishop's palace, and there's a very nice church down there that they keep maintained that no one attends. And you get a lot of people to be a part of them. Their archbishop for the region is down there because that's sort of the nature of how it goes. We've talked a little bit about that. But for Baptists, we don't have an external authority. When Dr. Laufer came to be the senior pastor, no one from outside University Baptist Church, no one in the local Union Baptist Association office said, you have to hire this guy. No, what it was, you had a search process. You had a search team. You collected resumes. You listened to people preach, and then you brought this guy in. I used to call it in lieu of a call, but I was told that's wrong. It's in view of a call to preach that one sermon, the little candy stick that you give everybody. And then you vote on him, probably after a little bit more intense interview process, just like I had almost a year ago. A year ago, we were in the process of finalizing things here at University Baptist for Mike moving from Sugar Land over to here. But again, they had a process. It was autonomous. We don't have anyone from outside telling us how to run our finances. We do that internally. So Baptist churches are unique in that way. And the one thing that we do is we as Baptists believe in association or cooperation with other like-minded churches. And we're going to talk about an associational model that was based out of Pennepec, Pennsylvania. So all that said, ultimately during the colonial period, two types of Baptists emerge, general Baptists and particular Baptists. Now, they primarily emerge over, this comes from the English version or the English view of Baptists, of a general atonement that is non-Calvinist or non-Reformed, and then a Calvinist one, which would be particular Baptist, a particular atonement, that Jesus died for a particular set of people set before the course of the world. But then there are some things that happen in America. The general Baptist becomes six principal Baptists, based out of Hebrews 6:1-2, and these are the things, repentance from dead works, faith towards God to receive salvation. You also have to repent to receive salvation, baptism, and we can always add by immersion following salvation, believer's baptism, resurrection of the dead, eternal judgment, and then also the laying on of hands as a sign of membership. There was a lot of stuff that happened. Part of the laying on of hands is when people would come to join your church, you would often, if you were a sixth principal Baptist, not just lay hands on them, you would also wash their feet. If you ever been to a good foot washing service, anybody in here been to a good foot washing service? Yeah, they don't do it in Baptist churches too often, but you can find them occasionally. A lot of Pentecostals will do that. Often, the one that I went to was I was in a band while I was in college, and we played a lot of unique gigs to get money. And one of them, we played a lot of Pentecostal tent revivals, which was kind of fun. And they had a foot washing service in the middle of it. Which was interesting. I'd never seen that before. Thankfully, they left their snakes at home. It's a snake handling church. We can talk about that later. But anyways, so those were the six principal Baptists. They would actually ultimately become free will Baptists. Within about a generation, they would want to be called free will Baptists. Then also the particular Baptists would be five principal Baptists because we can't agree on everything, so they would just do the no laying on of hands. During this time, Baptists were very strong advocates for universal liberty of religious conscience. They also advocated a separation of church and state. Now, the separation of church and state that they advocated was linked in with religious liberty. Now, what's funny is if you're watching the news these days, if you stay in the know on what's going on, we're still dealing with issues of religious liberty and church separation of church and state. Now, what's the guy that's Americans United for Separation of Church and State? He was Jerry Falwell's good friend. No, he wasn't. Barry Lynn? Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah, Barry Lynn, there you go. I'll get that one all the way from the back. It had a cobweb on it. But Barry Lynn is an advocate for a different kind of American separation of church and state. At this point, what we were advocating, what Baptists have always advocated for, is that the state does not interfere with the church. More particularly, that the state of Texas does not advocate for one type of religion, nor does the state of Texas advocate or get involved with churches in directing how they should function. This was a difference from what had happened for generations and centuries and, frankly, millennia up until now. This was freedom of conscience, freedom of individual liberty. And what happens with that, Baptists become some of the most significant proponents for religious liberty, That is that they were strong advocates for universal religious liberty of religious conscience. Baptists, which is interesting, during this time, were advocates for Judaism to come to the United States because Jews were beginning to come over and find different places in urban areas to resettle. They were also advocates for a unique religion called Mohammedism, which we now know as Islam, that they would be able to come, and they didn't come in droves, but as they came, that they could practice their religion. And what happened was Baptists held that banner up for many generations. The other thing, and we just sort of talked a little bit about this, the associational life became a hallmark of the American Baptist life, and it grew out of the Pennepec annual meetings. What's important about Pennepec is it was located in Pennsylvania. When you look, and if we remember from our conversation about religion in the 13 colonies, it had three distinct regions: the New England region, the middle colonies. Middle colonies were like New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Maryland were in there as middle colonies. And then you had the southern colonies, which were Virginia, Carolinas, and Georgia. And during that time, what happened is Anglicanism was very strong, or Church of England was very strong in the southern colonies. Congregationalism was very strong in the northern colonies, but freedom of religion was very strong in the middle colonies. And what happens in Pennepec is that the associational model that happens is all these Baptist churches, and we think that we act like it's a lot, it's really only like five or six, they would gather together occasionally to be able to meet for fellowship, for encouragement, but then also to be able to see a couple other things. The associational model allowed for six things. The first one was it helped be a doctrinal monitor. It helped be a doctrinal monitor. You had a group of churches that were checking each other out, making sure we're teaching what the Bible teaches. They also advised on church practices. How is baptism supposed to be celebrated? The big conversation point when it comes to the associational model is, should baptism be done in a river of running water, or should baptism be done in a pool of still water? There's a difference, because some people still believe that when you were baptized, what happened to your sins? They were literally washed away, so it was pretty bad luck to be a fish downstream. When Sam Houston was baptized in Texas, he commented, "I feel really bad for that fish downstream." So they believe that your sins were literally washed away. Now, Baptists don't believe that, but some of them did. Then also, clearing house for personnel matters. If you needed a new senior pastor, you'd go to the local association. Oh, yeah, this guy over here might be good for that. They help promote benevolent works, what we might call social justice today, helping the poor, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, providing shelter, those kinds of things. They provided fellowship for churches and leaders, and they also distributed different models of preaching. That's what associations were able to do. And during the 1700s, two major associations developed, Charleston and then also the Warren Association. So all that to say, by the end of the 1600s, Baptists were not strongly represented in the United States. They were not as strongly represented in the colonies. There was much independence and diversity. Usually a Baptist church was a rural and small congregation with informal worship, but a high emphasis on Bible teaching. And most Baptist ministers were unpaid. This was a big controversy amongst Baptists for about 100 years or so, that they believed that the clergy should be unpaid. There were some people that would remark that if you pay a pastor, you might as well convert back to Roman Catholicism, because it's that kind of heresy. Pastors shouldn't be paid. It's the work of God that they're about. So anyways, by 1700... And these are important notes. By 1700, there were about 24 Baptist churches in the 13 colonies. 24 Baptist churches in the 13 colonies, which made up of 839 members in America. By 1790, there were 979 churches. There were 67,490 members and there were 42 associations. So within 90 years, we see an explosion of Baptist churches. And this happens for two reasons. One was the population of 13 colonies went up, went down a little bit after during the Revolutionary War with all of the killing and whatnot, but there was a lot of immigration going on. People were beginning to know that as the New World was getting structured and settled, that it was safer to come, so they were coming more in droves. The transit on the Atlantic was increasingly safer. But then the other thing that happened was the Great Awakening happened, the First Great Awakening. And the First Great Awakening probably benefited Baptists more than any other denominational group in the American colonies, because it was still the colonies at this time. We talked a little bit about the revival several weeks ago. I'm just going to hit a couple of the highlights here, and then we're going to keep moving on. While Baptists had little to do initially with the awakening, they certainly reaped its benefits. Two groups emerged: the New Lights, which were pro-revival, and the Old Lights, which were anti-revival. There will always be in the United States a pro-revival and an anti-revival sentiment. There will be people that will look at an act of God or a work of God and say, we think that's too much, or we don't like how they're doing that, or God doesn't work that way. And this isn't to say that all those observations are inherently wrong. Sometimes it's good for us to go, hold on for a second. We need to evaluate whether this is truly a work of God. That's a good discerning practice. But there are some people who will stand in the way of the work of God just because they don't like things to change. So New Lights and Old Lights were developed. And out of this, Baptists would get many congregations coming out of New Light pro-revival sentiments. They'd also see Isaac Backus and Schubel Stearns, two leaders that would be added to there. There were some divisions that would develop. But they generally, between regular and separate Baptists. While the middle colonies were the primary center of Baptist growth in the 18th century, the New England and the southern colonies also saw growth. What's interesting is today, where are Baptist churches primarily located? In the Bible Belt. And the buckle moves depending upon wherever you live. Basically in the Sun Belt states. You go up to New England, it's hard to find a Southern Baptist church in New England. They're out there, it's just hard to find them. There's some good ones, too. I was born into one up in Massachusetts outside of Framingham. But they're hard to find. They're generally strong congregations, but what's interesting, even growing up in Maryland, my church that I grew up in, Calvary Baptist Church in Bel Air, Maryland, was of good size for the Maryland-Delaware Convention. We ran, at our height, about 450 people on Sunday. And we were one of the larger Baptist congregations in Maryland. But you go across the border down to Virginia, and if you're a healthy-sized Baptist church, you're generally running about 1,000 people, 800 to 1,000 people. So you see a little bit of a difference there. Also, returning back to this, by the end of the century, Baptist groups such as Free Will Baptist, Seventh-day Baptist, Separate Baptist, and Regular Baptist would begin emerging as distinct groups in Baptist life. But by and large, Baptists were still unified. There was some dividing that was happening between the North and South, but there were also some divisions that began happening with the East and the West. During this time, Baptists would help establish educational systems in the colonies, including grammar school academies throughout the colonies, and also Rhode Island College. Rhode Island College was the first Baptist college in America. Now, the grammar school academies are because there was no uniform public school system in the United States. That public school system didn't begin to develop until the last century, really the formalized part of it. But Baptists and other religious groups would have these grammar schools that would meet in the old one-room schoolhouse, and you would study those basic things. You'd study the reading, writing, and arithmetic. And also have Bible instruction that was a part of that. That's how children were educated. And Baptists were a very, very large advocates for that. But during this time, so that was the Great Awakening influence. And through the Great Awakening, we see that Baptists get the largest growth. And one of the reasons Baptist churches saw such a large growth out of the first and the second Great Awakening, and there's also a couple that happened in the 1800s that Baptists reaped some rewards from. One of the things that happened out of it is because the Baptist model of church is a very flexible model. Because there isn't a bishop telling you have to do this liturgy this way with this kind of song service following this. The Baptist churches are, by and large, free to adapt to their culture. I could leave here and I could go to my parents' church, which is a Baptist church in Lynchburg, Virginia, and the format of their worship would be similar, but there would be different parts of it. There would be different ways that they did stuff from maybe even our 9:30 service. But think about how even University Baptists, we have different adaptation in worship. We have our 9:30 service, but then we also have our 11 o'clock service that uses a slightly different format than 9:30. Doesn't include certain things. So there's an adaptability. Baptists were able to grow during the 1700s and 1800s with such vigor because of the adaptability of their congregations to a preaching style, to their church model, to how they went about church. That's a great strength of Baptist churches. So Baptist church traditions, and this is, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, and this is where I've got a couple slides. There were two distinct traditions that emerged in Baptist life. The first one is Sandy Creek. It was led by a guy named Shubal Stearns and his buddy Daniel Marshall in Sandy Creek, North Carolina. In November of 1755, and it would become a major movement. These are a couple of their distinctives. They were separate Baptists, but they were not generally known for being rigid in their theology. They weren't rigidly Calvinistic, but they used also emotive worship and preaching. Now, by emotive worship, that could mean that some of your churches would have an amen corner. Some of these churches, has anybody ever been to a Baptist church that has a runner, has like a sort of that running congregation? Guys will run around the sanctuary while the preacher preaches. It seems very Pentecostal. That's a Baptist thing. You got a guy, he just gets the itch, and he just gets up, and he just starts running around the congregation. There's a YouTube clip that's out there. It's a great clip, and I didn't think to include it, but it's at one of these dancing Baptist churches, and this guy starts jumping up and around the pews, and he's going all the way around, and he starts from the front, and their camera position, it's sort of like up there, and you see this guy jumping, then you see him go down the other side, and then he hops up on the platform, and he jumps up one pew, jumps up the third pew, and as he jumps into the baptistry, someone had filled it. So all this water comes out. It's one of those running Baptist churches. That's a kind of a tradition that would happen. Those are Sandy Creek traditions. The pastor will not stand in formal robes necessarily behind the lectern or the pulpit, but will have maybe preach. They'll preach from a rail, or they'll preach out among the congregation, sort of coming down off of a platform to preach like this. And they'll use different forms of illustrations. It's less formal. Generally an uneducated clergy that were not paid. Very low church forms. They were informal. And they were skeptical of creeds and confessions to bind churches together. And they were also skeptical of General Baptists. Up here, let me sort of show you what we got. This is Sandy Creek Baptist Church. A little bit reconstructed because the one that got started in 1755 didn't last. One of the things that you notice, a couple things about this, is it's somewhat square. The average Baptist church size was 30 foot by 40 foot. And that's all that it was. There's no educational space. There's no children's space. There's no preschool space. It was really this. This is what the inside of Sandy Creek Baptist Church looks like. So you see, you've got your pews that are right there. Now, it's nice. They've added the pew covers. They would not have the pew covers. The other thing that you'll see is you have a little bit of a balcony right up in here. I've got another picture of that. You've got your, you also have the congregation would sit here, back here, and then certain members of the congregation would stand up top. Now, who would be the certain members of the congregation? Slaves and other minorities that weren't seen as full participants in the congregation. But then also, this would be the pulpit area. You'll see there's a rail right there. This is a little bit better of a shot. It gives you the sort of, there's a little ladder to get up to here to the balcony. You've got another congregational, but this is where the preacher would preach from. This is Sandy Creek Baptist Church. And this is what it looks like. And you can go there today. If you go to Sandy Creek, North Carolina, they'll let you walk around. It's a historical site. What's interesting is in Sandy Creek tradition, women also had roles in the church. We read about how many Sandy Creek churches had deaconesses, had eldresses, and also had teaching elders that were women. This is in 1700s, the mid-1700s, the late 1700s. Baptists were innovators in reclaiming women in ministry. that was a pattern of the early church, particularly the Sandy Creek. Now, the second one that would come out would be the Charleston tradition, and this is rooted out of Charleston, South Carolina. This is First Baptist Church, Charleston, South Carolina. You can go to Charleston today, which I think is a great trip, by the way, and as you walk around town, right there on sort of the western wall of the seawall, you walk up one house in, and you run into Charleston, First Baptist Church of Charleston. This was started by William Screven, either in 1708 or 1751, depending upon who you talk to. The Charleston tradition was started in either 1708 or 1751. The 1751 is really seen as the renewal of the Charleston tradition. But you'll notice a couple things. What's one of the major differences between the Sandy Creek and the Charleston, just the church edifice? It's much nicer. Charleston tradition churches are largely urban, or because suburbs didn't exist until the 1950s, really post-World War II. But it's really that urban environment with more well-to-do people. So you see a couple of things. You got those columns. This is the inside of the Charleston, First Baptist Church, Charleston. And it goes along with this. You'll see more sober worship and preaching. The minister will stand behind the pulpit, which is a more formal, elevated platform. I don't know if you can see my pointer. It's right there. It's that elevated platform. And the minister would likely grasp either side and read from a manuscript, but would not move from that position. The other thing that would happen is sort of a high church form. It was more formal. A choir would be present. Other instruments would be present. Sandy Creek was an a cappella congregation. It was usually an educated clergy. They conformed by and large to the Second London Baptist Confession. They were confessional and used associational ties. A couple of the other things that you see in the sort of the difference in the Charleston tradition, obviously it's a more formal environment. You'll also notice that the ceiling is high. So when we think about Sandy Creek, we call it a low church form. We call a Charleston tradition a high church form. Ceiling has a way to designate that. But you'll also notice that there's something that's missing from other high churches. There's no statuary. There are not paintings or mosaics on the walls or in front of you in the transept, like you might find in a Catholic church. Up in the nave that you might find in the Catholic church. But you'll also see that they have formal pew boxes, and each pew box has the entry and out, and so forth. You also have the columns up in the right-hand corner, my right-hand corner, your left-hand corner, you'll see the pipe organ. It's more formal instrumentation. So the difference between Sandy Creek and Charleston tradition, a lot of churches can trace their roots to either a Sandy Creek or a Charleston tradition. You'll find Charleston tradition churches in the 1700s and 1800s in urban environments, and you'll primarily find Sandy Creek in rural environments. And it's just sort of two different kinds of church form. With that. So Baptists in the, this is sort of the bottom of page two, Baptists in the 18th century were made up of common people, an educated clergy, and generally simple 30 by 40 churches, but they expected deep Bible sermons. They also were highly evangelistic, and by 1800 were growing in educational and social systems. So things began changing. Baptists grew in number. But they also began growing in influence, and two of the primary influencers were two individuals, Isaac Backus and John Leland. And this is a good picture of Isaac Backus. And Isaac was, you see his life dates there, he was perhaps the greatest spokesman for religious liberty in America. He is responsible for much of how we understand religious liberty. His writings and his letters to editors, his letters to appointed officials, had a lot of gravity. Two of his great works were Government and Liberty Described and Ecclesiastical Tyranny Exposed in 1778, and then a second one, An Appeal to the People of Massachusetts State Against Arbitrary Power, which he wrote in 1780. He really sought to keep the state out of religion and made it a Baptist principle. And then we had this fella. This is John Leland. And I've found this one. This is actually a good quote from John Leland that sort of explains who he is. Government should protect every man in thinking and speaking freely and see that one does not abuse another. The liberty I contend for is more than toleration. The very idea of toleration is despicable. It supposes that some have a preeminence above the rest to grant indulgence, whereas all should be equally free, Jews, Turks, pagans, and Christians. Who's a Turk at this time? Muslims, yeah. This is religious liberty. This is a fundamental statement of religious liberty. We, and this is the innovation of the American dream, it is, or the American experiment, I guess, it is that we are all equal in terms of in how the state views us. Not one is greater than another. The American, and I know we can talk about how it stands today, but the idea of America was to level the playing field, that the president is not able to break the law, but is beholden to the law, just as I am beholden to the law. That's rooted in the American system. John Leland brought about much of that. One of his most famous works, you'll see that, The Rights of Conscience and Alienable in 1791. Here's the total title. Hold on for a second because it goes on for a couple minutes. The Rights of the Conscience Inalienable, and therefore religious opinions not cognizable by law or the high-flying churchman stripped of his legal robe appears a yahoo. That was the entire title of his tract. That he basically, in it, he argued for three things: the rights of conscience as inalienable rights. He was one of the first to adopt John Locke's terminology in religious circles, that these truths are inalienable. The rights, that is, what are the inalienable rights that are enumerated with the Declaration of Independence? Right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, John Locke, when he wrote it, wrote life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, but Thomas Jefferson adapted it, the pursuit of happiness. Those are unalienable rights. Also that religion established by law always harms religion. And then the third point, and this is something that should still speak to us today, particularly this year, that motives to establish religion as the basis of the state always seek to buttress the power of civil authorities and augment the purses of an ambitious clergy. That religion shouldn't be in the middle of the state, and the state shouldn't be in the middle of religion. This is what John Leland did. He was a major influence on Washington and Madison, and through John Leland's work, we have the First Amendment. He was probably the one person who crafted the language of the First Amendment, of the Bill of Rights, more than anybody else. So, moving along. Baptists in the 19th century, after some major advances in the 18th century, the 19th century would become the great century for Baptist advance, but also for their divisions. Perhaps the most important event happened in Philadelphia when the Triennial Convention was convened. This was a missions sending agency, and we talked a little bit about the Triennial Convention. At the first, you see there's some things that happened. Luther Rice was one of the first people commissioned by the Triennial Convention to go do foreign missions. Out of the United States, out of the early colonies, out of this new nation, one of the greatest missionary forces ever to go out into all the world came through Baptist life. And even today, after all the stuff that's been going on over the last couple months, Southern Baptists still have one of the largest, if not the largest, funded, fully funded missionary bases, missionary groups out in the world. So yet divisions were arising. There's a couple other things. One of the first appointed foreign missionaries was Charlotte H. White, a single lady who was sent with the Ho family to Burma. This was a big controversy because she felt called to Burma to go do missions there. And they said, well, we can't send a woman by herself because she'll be killed, she'll be attacked, she just won't be able to fend for herself, but we want to validate her call. So the Ho family, who was also going to Burma, they allowed her to go with them. She ended up, as soon as she got there, she found the missionary whose wife had passed away, and within a few months they were arranged to be married. But she was one of the first missionaries appointed by the Triennial Convention. A second major group was formed, the Baptist Tract Society. they would have a great ministry. Now, we think of tracts as those little things that people leave for waiters and waitresses, and they had like the $10,000 bill, and that apparently relieves us of having to tip them, which it doesn't. But it's one of those things that that's not what we're necessarily what we're talking about. We're talking about pamphlets. We're talking about things that people would hand out, little things, little information pieces. Also, the American Baptist Home Mission Society was formed in 1832. This was goals was the evangelization of North America. And during the first year, 89 missionaries were appointed to 10 states. And that's in 1832. But within 12 years, they had 97 missionaries serving on the field. And 551 new churches had been started. And they had baptized 14,426 converts to Christianity. Missions is at the heart of what it meant to be a Baptist in the 19th century. Yet, in all of this, Baptists still saw their ranks beginning to see division. There was an old school group that began, and they ultimately broke off. They called themselves Primitive Baptists. Has anybody been to a primitive or seen a primitive Baptist church? What's it like? It's very primitive. They don't believe in air conditioning or heating. They don't believe in music, instrumentation for singing, so it's a cappella. And then here's the one that really gets you. The pastor is not supposed to prepare a sermon. The pastor is supposed to, as they stand up to preach, the Holy Spirit will guide them to whatever text they should go through that Sunday. So no preparation. You open the Bible, you read the text, and then you expound upon it. This is the nature of primitive Baptist. We had a primitive Baptist church in the town where I grew up. It was a very small congregation, about 30 people. But they had lasted. That church, there, a little thing on the side, had been built in 1845. And they had been there ever since, and they didn't have any need to add anything to it. So they didn't have any modernization. One of the most significant events that happened were the Campbellite movements. Alexander Campbell created, and you can see some of the detail there, created the group called Church of Christ. The Church of Christ believed that baptism is regenerational. Now, you got some data in there about them. I'll let you read that. I'll give you a little story about that real quick. There's a reason Baptists and Church of Christ don't get along in Texas and Oklahoma, because one of the things that would happen is a Church of Christ congregation would begin meeting in a town, and they'd start with a Bible study, and they would start growing and growing, and they'd have a lot of people meeting in this house very quietly. Then they would decide, they'd go to the local First Baptist Church, or the largest First Baptist Church in town, and they would begin getting involved slowly. They'd start joining, and people are like, man, this is amazing, revival's breaking out, we're having members like crazy coming. And then as soon as the last member joined, what they would do is they would call a business meeting, vote the pastor out, fire all of the deacons, and fire him, and fire all of the deacons, replace them as leaders, and then take the property over and convert it from a Baptist church into a Church of Christ church. So that's why Baptist and Church of Christ people don't get along. That happened back in the 1800s. Leon Macbeth talks a little bit about it in his book over there. But last things last, talk real quick about the Southern Baptist Convention. One of the things that we run into with the Sandy Creek tradition is there. The Southern Baptist Convention has a bit of rooting more in Sandy Creek. But Baptists in the mid-1800s were dealing with growth but also divisions because America was dealing with division. Basically what had happened is a group of Baptists in the South wanted to meet and get together and talk about the differences between the Northern Baptists and the Southern Baptists, because there were some disparities going on. The Triennial Convention was in hard days, there were three primary issues that were going on, basically that they wanted to form out of. One was the method of organization. You see, the South is more spread out because of the nature of plantations, the rural living. So they needed a stronger associational base. But Northern Baptists wanted to be more independent. It was easier for them to meet whenever they needed to because they were closer geographically. Also, there were problems with home missions. Though the Southern states gave less to the Home Mission Society, Southerners didn't see the fruit of missions or feel that they had equal appointments of missionaries to their region. One of the primary reasons of this is a lot of the missionaries that were appointed by the North said, I don't want to go to the South because they have slaves, and slavery is immoral. And the Southerners said, well, we want missionaries. We want to grow our work. What ended up happening, actually, there was a pretty even distribution of missionaries. A lot of them were going out to the frontier area and to the west, which was like Missouri and Iowa, to try to get things going out in that area. And ultimately, slavery. And as Macbeth points out, as Robert Baker points out, as any solid historian points out, slavery was the issue the Southern Baptist Convention was primarily created around and because of. This was the main issue behind the schism. There were many anti-slavery movements in the South, but the vast majority of Southern churches that were Baptist were pro-slavery. And again, not trying to get too far into the context of the time, but in the mid-1800s, there was a massive issue in the United States between abolitionist and pro-slavery groups. And anybody that sits there and tries to tell you the Civil War wasn't fought because of slavery hasn't read the declarations of Confederation that were brought about, or secession, that were brought about by the Southern states. To a state, every one of them talks about maintaining the institution of slavery against our northern aggressors in some form or fashion, to a state. So this was the issue. It was, now we can talk about states' rights in the Civil War, and I don't want to get too far into that because this is more important than that right now. But this was the issue the Southern Baptists became out of. Now, for what it's worth, I think that the Southern Baptist Convention has gone to great lengths to try to repair that sin. And has done what it can, as best it can. I don't know how long a convention has to be, or a group or an institution has to be held over to the bounds of people that were generations before it. But if it is any hope, I know that the convention theme this summer is racial reconciliation. We're still dealing with this. But nevertheless, so efforts were taken to try to create some unity, but to no avail. Two final straws would ultimately lead to the division. One, and there are two test cases. One was the Georgia test. The Southern states sought to, or the Southern Baptists sought to appoint James E. Reeve to the international mission field. But the Triennial Convention by this point had a standing rule that no slave-owning individual could be a foreign missionary. So they appointed him specifically to go after this, and the Triennial Convention pocket vetoed him. They just didn't act on it. But then the other thing that happened was the Alabama resolution. Alabama Baptists submitted a blunt inquiry if slaveholders could be foreign missionaries, and the Triennial Convention strongly rebuked them. So out of these two cases, they decided to meet in Augusta, Georgia, and on May 8th, 1845, 293 actual persons. There's 327 delegates because some of the delegates represented multiple churches or multiple agencies. Voted to begin a new convention of the South. And the Southern Baptist began with 4,126 churches and 351,000 members. And they began with three agencies: the Foreign Mission Board, the Home Mission Board, and the Sunday School Board. And what's the Foreign Mission Board called today? The International Mission Board. And what's the Home Mission Board called today? The North American Mission Board. And what is the Sunday School Board called today? Lifeway. Those are the three original agencies that the Southern Baptist Convention created. Now, they've added a couple more to them, and they've adopted a couple other seminaries as well. But this began the Southern Baptist. Now, what ended up happening, and Macbeth points this out, that if the Southern Baptist, if the Baptists hadn't split north and south, within 5 years they would have split east and west. And because Baptists are known for our, unfortunately at this time, divisions. But out of this, thankfully, through the mercy of God, we were able to see a good work through many generations. So this gives us an overview of Baptists from the 1600s up to the Civil War. There's a lot to be said about that. Next week, we'll be covering chapters 20 or 32 and 33. And I appreciate each of your guys' time tonight. So have a great night.